I'd like to introduce you to the next speaker, Jill Cotsall, who's actually going to speak on the subject of Women for Change, why you should join the Socialist Party. And her talk's going to last approximately 45 minutes.
Thanks, Adam. Right, in this talk I'm going to argue that women should join the Socialist Party for four main reasons. Firstly, that men cannot bring about socialism on behalf of women. Secondly, that women have the ability to engage in political action in cooperation with men necessary to bring socialism about. And thirdly, that women cannot achieve true freedom or full emancipation within the social system which we now live in. And fourthly, that women can be fully self-determining human beings in the context of a socialist society. I apologise to those of you who've heard some of this before in the previous talks. Right, so these points are going to take different amounts of time for me to make. The first point is quite straightforward and it won't take very long. Socialist society cannot ever be achieved without the support of the majority of working women throughout the world, actively taking part in bringing it about. We should be under no illusions about this. If socialism is to be a democratic society without leaders, in which we all collectively determine the way in which we live, and by definition socialism must be this, then women, as half of the population, must play an active part in running that society. And I would argue that anyone who's not able to participate in bringing about this society will have difficulty in participating in its running. Women and men are not two halves of one whole, and despite what the present system may want us to think about our personal relationships, women and men are autonomous human beings. And therefore, the man in a couple, as perhaps the more confident or outgoing, cannot place his vote, in inverted commas, for socialism on behalf of his wife, lover, daughter, friend or comrade. There can be no family vote for socialism, like there is a family wage in capitalism. Women must exercise their full autonomy in wanting, bringing about, and working within socialism. If this were not the case, then I would dread to think what a future socialist society would be like, and I certainly wouldn't want any part of it. My second point concerns women and political action. Women have been involved actively in political and trade union activity throughout the history of capitalism and before. However, women suffer from a disadvantage in trying to be aware of their own political history. The reason is history itself. Often women's political struggles have gone unrecorded in a similar way to the history of the whole working class. This is due to the way history is distorted along with every other social product in capitalist society. The history of property-owning society is the history of great men, in inverted commas. And working women have suffered in this respect from being neither great in capitalist terms nor men. However, some women writers in recent times have tried to redress this imbalance in the recording of recent history and have researched into some of the political struggles of working women. Sheila Rowbotham, in her book Hidden from History, is a case in point. She takes us back to the early stages of capitalist society at a time when feudal customs were being eroded and the principle of profit-making was beginning to be dominant. And she states, "But the women of the poor were by no means passive. They played an active part in the continuing struggle of the 18th century crowd to maintain the right of the poor to a cheap loaf. Women pelted on popular dealers. Because women of the poor had an immediate connection to consumption, they were prominent in these class struggles of the marketplace," unquote. As capitalism developed, working people found new ways of resisting their increased exploitation for profit. Even though they were illegal, trade unions began to form. Women supported and participated in these trade unions, and also in the Chartist movement, which was a result of early unionisation. They also participated in demonstrations for political reform. As Sheila Rowbotham records, how they were among the victims who fell beneath the soldiers' charge at a demonstration for political reform at St. Peter's Fields in Manchester in 1819. Women began to form their own reform societies, around this time. Within these societies, women did not at that time distinguish their own interests from the interests of the rest of their class. However, they were aware of the resistance to their political involvement from men within their own class. The Female Political Union of Newcastle-upon-Tyne printed the following statement in 1839 in the Chartist newspaper, the Morning Star. Quote, I quote, "We have been told that the province of women is her home and that the field of politics should be left to men. This we deny. The nature of things renders this impossible, and the conduct of those who give the advice is at variance with the principles that they assert." Robotham relates how women continued to be active in trade unions and political movements in general throughout the whole of the 19th century. However, women's unionisation lagged behind that of men's. There were several reasons for this, all of them related to capitalists' exploitation of women. Firstly, some male workers were hostile to women in their own unions. They did not support their fellow women workers, preferring instead to argue that women workers lowered wages and, especially in times of unemployment, took men's jobs. On the basis of this, they argued for a family wage. Though this was by no means always the case, where these attitudes did exist, they served to reinforce women's own perceptions of themselves. This perception was that paid employment was a secondary role for women, and their primary occupation was that of homemakers and child rearers. This is an example of how capitalism creates competition between men and women for its own ends. In trying to convince women that their main role is in the home, it can reduce the chances of women unionising, lower women's pay levels, which in turn lowers male workers' pay levels. And in time when their labour is surplus to market requirements, capitalism can quite easily push them back into the home. So women have a political history, but these factors that I've mentioned already have militated against their fuller participation in political and trade union activity. Capitalism's ideology has not stopped women working for their own emancipation. Women have succeeded, despite obstacles, in securing the vote and taking active part in trade unions and political organisations. In 1904, when the Socialist Party was formed, women were among the founding members. And despite some of the less enlightened views from some of the male members, women have succeeded in this party in becoming active and influential speakers and organisers. Some of the more prominent speakers and organisers who spring to mind were women such as Stella Jackson, Lisa Bryan, Sheila Ritchie, Joan Lester, Hilda Korn and Pat Deutz. Women are still active in the Socialist Party, and by the nature of its democratic organisation, they cannot be barred from any activity or position within the party. At the moment, at this very moment, two of the editors on our monthly journal are women. Women sit on the executive committee and on the subcommittees. However, there is no doubt that we need more women in this party, and that's partly what this talk is about. I hope in this section I've been able to illustrate that women do have a political past and that they can have a political future. I want to go on now to make the point that women cannot achieve full emancipation in a capitalist society. Women have made gains during the last century. Attitudes towards women are changing. With the advent of contraception, some women are now able to have more control over their own fertility. Some women now have more economic dependence from men due to their increasing participation in paid employment. Now, I don't mean to trivialise these gains. However, the point I want to stress is that full emancipation, by which I mean the right of a woman to complete self-determination in all important areas of her life, cannot be achieved in a system which gains from the exploitation and subordination of women. I would argue that the profit system in which we live gains from women's subordination in a number of ways. Firstly, as mentioned earlier, women form a reserve pool of labour for the profit makers. Women's conditioned role as homemakers and child nurturers can be used to justify the payment of lower wages for similar work to that of men. And this role can and has been used throughout this century to justify women being forced back into the home when it is not profitable to employ them. Secondly, as Marlene Dixon, in her book The Future for Women, points out, women's traditional role allows them to be super exploited by the profit makers, because women do not receive even the market value for services which they perform in the home. Some women have low-paid jobs and also work unrecompensed for hours looking after the next generation of workers, i.e. their own children at home. Along with the exploitation of male workers, this super-exploitation of those who work within the home serves capitalism's drive for profit. The Equal Pay and Sex Discrimination Acts have failed, a decade after they were passed, to make any significant improvements in the position of the majority of working women. As was pointed out yesterday, women on average still only earn about 65% of what men do on average. I would argue that this is because the concept of rights within capitalism is an empty concept. When you have little money in your pocket, the so-called rights that capitalism bestows on a woman are empty rights. Of course, you have the legal rights to leave your spouse if you have the money to find alternative accommodation for you and your children. Of course, you also have a legal right to equal employment opportunities if you can convince your prospective employers that the care of your children will not interfere with their full exploitation of you. This is even worse in times of high unemployment. While I was writing this, it brought to mind my own experience of struggling through about 4 pages of Equal Opportunities manifesto attached to a job application that I was about to fill out. Now, as I neared the end of this blurb, the possibility occurred to me that the job might not even exist, because some employers have a legal obligation to advertise some jobs, especially in the public sector, when in actual fact they already have internal candidates lined up for those jobs. So much for equal employment opportunities. It's okay if the jobs actually exist. Before I move on to the final part of this talk, I would like to give 2 examples of rights within capitalism taken from recent articles in The Guardian. The first concerns the Altman Bill, currently being debated, which would reduce the legal abortion limit to 18 weeks. The particular article concerns Ms. Vera Horton, quotes a reformist for 40 years and a member of the Abortion Law Reform Society during the 50s. She's campaigning at the minute against the violation of a woman's right to choose what to do with her own body. And the article informs us that since the Abortion Act of 1967, there have been 14 attempts to tamper with abortion rights. And it goes on to state, Vera Horton believes that the medical profession will not let such a serious erosion of the 1967 Act happen. She also puts her faith in Parliament. That is where it all happens. I cannot imagine this bill going through without exceptions. I cannot think that Parliament would be so blind. And then, that's interesting, because in the same Guardian, dated Wednesday, January the 20th, 1988, there's another article entitled Altman Opponents Prepare for Defeat with Plans to Amend the Abortion Bill. And I'll just read you a passage from it. It goes, MPs fighting Mr. David Altman's abortion bill to cut the abortion time limit are mounting a damage limitation exercise in the face of a probable substantial defeat in Friday's vote. They accept that their only hope is to minimise the Commons majority in favour of a second reading to curb the number of Mr. Altman's supporters on the committee, which will then shape the bill for its third reading later this year. So, Altman's supporters are fighting using the argument of the rights of the unborn child. The second example, capitalism is able to pose the rights of one group of workers against the rights of another group of workers, some of them unborn. The second article, dated February the 2nd, concerns a link between pornography, the exploitation of women's sexuality for profit, and violence. And I'll just read you a passage from it. It says, Evidence of the links between pornography and sexual violence are published today. The complete and unedited transcript of the public hearings held in Minneapolis City Council in 1983 when it was considered whether or not to add pornography as discrimination against women to its existing civil rights legislation. So, if we bear in mind that the horrifying catalogue of sexual violence actually practiced against women that we heard about yesterday, I'd like to read a further bit from this article, bearing in mind the sexual violence. This is the material described by Polly Tombey in her Guardian column in 1981. She's describing pornographic literature. Scenes of torture, castration, flaying, cannibalism, after the crushing of breasts in a vice, exploding vaginas packed with hand grenades, eyes gouged out, beatings, dismemberings, burnings, multiple rape, women engaged in sexual intercourse with dogs and pigs. Now, so the outcome of this article is the pornographers claimed that they were being denied their constitutional right to free speech. The legislators argued that pornography was a violation of civil rights of women. The courts accepted evidence of harm, including the case that pornography is a root cause of sex discrimination. But in the end, they decided that free speech, as practiced by the pornographers, took precedence over women's equality and safety from violence. I think really those articles speak for themselves as to the nature of rights within capitalism. I would argue that in a society of abundance of goods and services, and one based on cooperation in controlling the resources of the world, only in this sort of society can women be truly self-determining in all aspects of their lives. This society is socialism, and it stands in contrast to capitalism, which is based upon competition and false scarcity of resources. As far back as the beginning of the last century, radical thinkers realised that a society based on cooperation was essential for the true liberation of women. For instance, William Thompson, in his appeal of 1825, writes, "Nothing short of voluntary association or the mutual cooperation of industry and talents in large numbers could entirely heal the flagrant evils of our present artificial social system, and particularly the desolating injustice practiced on women." Thompson realised that the task of bearing and rearing children had placed women at a disadvantage in the context of a system in which they had to compete with male workers. This unequal competition between men and women has been characteristic of all societies which are based on private property, including the present system under which we live. Even in feudal society, where work was carried out by women within the household, productive work, that is, Sheila Robotham writes on this subject, and I quote, "Among the peasantry, women were essential in the family economy. The peasant's wife bore children, which meant that more hands to the toil, and she laboured herself. She was like cattle, a means of production. In peasant households, the man owned the woman and the power to labour. This was the rule of patriarchy at its strongest. Women in property society have always been unequal. There is evidence, however, to suggest that in older societies, not based on private property, women's status was equal to that of men. In these societies, where there was a division of labour along sexual lines, there is no evidence to suggest that women's work was considered more menial or less important than men's." In his study of hunter-gatherer societies, E.R. Service writes, "Food gathering is the major enterprise, of course, but more than that, it is a direct confrontation of man with nature. That is to say, there are no specialised groups who get their food by buying it from the producer or exchanging services for it in some way. There is no full-time specialisation of labour other than the domestic age and sex divisions which are found in any family. Among hunter-gathering peoples, the division of labour is simply that men do the hunting, at least the kind of hunting that takes them away from any distance from the camp, and women, probably because of their relative confinement of bearing and rearing children, are left to forage near the camp for vegetables, food, and such small game as can be easily caught. But this does not mean that men's hunting is necessarily of greater economic importance than women's work. In some hunter-gatherer communities that Servus studied, the food gathered by women made up to 70 or 80% of the community's diet. Now, the main point of this illustration is to show that in a propertyless society, the division of labour along sexual lines did not result in a lower social status for women as it does in property society. These early societies were subsistence societies. That is, they gathered only enough food to exist from day to day, and there was no surplus left over. As communities became more settled and began to learn techniques of farming land to produce food, it became possible to produce enough food so that some was surplus to day-to-day requirements of the community. This gave rise to the possibility of exchanging that surplus for other goods. I'm now going to quote from the Socialist Party's pamphlet on women and socialism, as it puts this better than I can. Right, and I quote, "With the shift to horticulture, men increasingly took responsibility for those areas of productive work which yielded a surplus. Men's predominant role in trade may originally have been a function both of their relatively greater mobility and of their traditional absence from the home site to hunt or fight. Women's work was largely unchanged, being concerned with subsistence activities. However, these activities became relatively devalued once the possibility for production for exchange developed." Now, end of quote. The authors go on to point out that as society's productive capacity grew, women's work increasingly lost status, and that this had implications for their social and political status, and they were increasingly excluded from public and political life. I've spent some time stressing this point about women's decreasing status in property society because it's relevant to the future of women's position in a socialist society. As already mentioned, the division of labour in subsistence societies was probably necessary for the purely practical reason that everybody had to engage in production every day in the most efficient way possible if they were all to eat. In the case of members of the community who bore children, because they were less mobile for some of the time, it was more efficient for them to work near the home. However, in a society which could produce a surplus, this practical necessity was turned into a political and economic advantage in favour of men, and then, consequently, in favour of classes as society progressed. Coming back to the present day, capitalism is now capable of producing an abundance of goods and services so that everybody's needs can be satisfied. As productive technology has developed, the amount of time that people need to engage in productive work so that everybody's needs are satisfied has decreased. In short, I'm saying that the sexual division of labour is no longer necessary. It can no longer be justified on the grounds of practical necessity. The reasons that it still exists have been discussed earlier. That is, it works in favour of the need of this society to produce greater and greater profits. A society liberated from the profit motive could be a society of abundance, and everybody could reap the benefits of this abundant capacity. Women's position would change in a socialist society, because taking advantage of the productive capacity which now exists would mean that the nature of work would change radically. To expand my argument, I'm again going to quote from another Socialist Party pamphlet. This one's from Capitalism to Socialism, How We Live and How We Could Live. And I quote, "Work will undergo a complete change as socialist society develops. We have noted the fact that capitalist society is extremely wasteful of human labour in many ways and only introduces labour-saving automation when profitable. At present levels of production, therefore, the actual amount of work needed of one person could be much less than it is now. Living in a society of equality, we shall have direct influence upon whatever work we do. The workplace, the tools, the organisation, the quality and quantity of goods and services that we provide will be our concern and under our democratic control." Okay. At this point, I want to engage in a bit of idle speculation, in inverted commas, about the implications for women of the democratically controlled production in socialist society. Firstly, if we control when and how we work, then the patterns of work will become much more flexible. Women will not be either forced to choose between working or looking after children, or be forced to work full-time and take on the additional burdens of childcare as well. A situation we see happening more and more in the society. People will have greater variety in the work that they do, maybe working a few hours at one job, a few hours at another job. Women may choose to work full-time and have childcare taken over by somebody else. Alternatively, some women may choose to work all the time with children for a certain period of time. Some men may choose to work all the time with children. This is already happening, this sort of flexibility, is already happening to a limited extent in this society. For instance, some couples who choose to swap roles, with the woman working and the man being house husband. Now, these couples are usually in a position of having the choice afforded by a greater income, which permits one of them not to work. However, not many couples are in this financial position. And in cases where the man is forced to stay at home through unemployment, the gains of a woman being free from full-time childcare are partly offset by the poverty of only having one, usually inadequate wage, with which to keep the whole family. The possibilities of this more enlightened attitude towards childcare in the context of a society of abundance are absolutely endless. At the moment, couples who choose to swap roles are in a limited position because the resources that they can muster for the care of their children are limited to what they, as an isolated nuclear family, can provide. I would argue that in a socialist society, due to the increasing control we will have over the way in which we live, people would want to take advantage of the whole community caring for young people. Karima yesterday mentioned some examples of communities where this already happens, and I can think of other examples. For instance, today in the small islands off the mainland of Greece, the different attitudes to young people by older people are noticeable. Almost everybody in the community knows the children and takes some responsibility for watching them as they play in the streets. Young children can be much freer because of this. They don't have to stay in one small area where their parents can watch them. Socialist society would be devoid of the property relationships that characterise the society in which we live now. Therefore, although children may be closer to their immediate parents than to anybody else, they won't be considered the property of these parents. I would argue that in an atmosphere of community care, the community care of young people will become the normal thing. I mean, we can discuss this later. Allowing both mothers and their children greater choice and freedom in their lives. Women will be free to develop their talents and interests to the full in any area they wish. In short, they will be free to be fully self-determining human beings. I've concentrated here on the possibilities for childcare because it's a central factor in most women's lives. However, within the context of a socialist society where women are not super exploited for profit, there are other factors which will contribute to our emancipation. For instance, our sexuality will not be exploited for profit, with all of the resulting degradation as it is now. Consequently, respect for women as fellow human beings will increase. In the context of a moneyless society in which people can take freely what they need to live and be happy, women's economic dependence on men will be gone forever, giving us complete freedom of movement. Now, this isn't meant to be a definitive statement on women's position in a socialist society, and I haven't in this talk even looked at the implications for men of this sort of society. So I hope that we can discuss and argue about the possibilities in the time that follows this talk. However, the main point has been that it would be to the advantage of women to work for a socialist society, because it's the only society in which they can take their freedom, not beg for it by petitioning politicians or lawmakers, not demand it by protesting in the streets, but simply take it using the abundance of resources that society has to offer. Socialism will provide for women's emancipation because it's the only social system which, having no regard for profit making, can take full advantage of the abundance of resources which the earth has to offer. The Socialist Party at the moment is the only party which is working for the society which I've described. This society is not possible without women to bring it about. So, in conclusion, I would urge all women who have thought about the possibilities of socialism and who agree with our aims to join us. Thank you.